All right. Why don't we get started? It occurred to me, talking to somebody a few minutes ago, that one possible paper topic, which I don't think I listed on the webpage, though I'm not sure, would be fanfic. For people who are familiar with fanfic, is fiction, amateur fiction, set in the world of some existing work of fiction. So if you have a story about Captain Kirk and Spock, and you write that story and put it up on the web, that's fanfic. And it's interesting, sort of, for an IP standpoint, from several different directions. One of them is arguably fanfic violates the IP, the copyright of the original work. And it would be interesting at least to look at, have there been any litigation over that? I presume that at least some cases the original copyright owner says, well, that's just fine, it's just getting me additional attention, but there might be others who object to it. And the other is that because fanfic pretty clearly can't itself be protected by copyright, isn't in practice, and I suspect it would be very difficult given that it's a derivative work without authorization, that it gives you an example of the production of literature in a world where it's in the world we'll be in if we can't enforce copyright law, essentially. And also, I gather, though I don't know, that there are sort of institutions in the fanfic community by which you try to figure out which ones are worth reading. That, in my view, the fundamental problem with self-publishing at this point is the lack of a decent filter. That at the moment, I don't know how many of you are interested in writing your own books, but if you want to write a book, 20 years ago, the only two ways really of getting published were either to persuade a commercial publisher that your book was worth publishing, which was hard to do, or to go to what was called a vanity press, which meant that in effect you were really paying the cost of publishing the book. You were then selling 20 copies to your relatives and telling people, look, I'm a published author. Nowadays, you can self-publish at essentially very close to zero cost, either as an ebook, which you can not only put on your web page, but you can get Amazon to put up on Amazon's Kindle source, and they will sell it for you, or you can self-publish as a print-on-demand book, in which case Amazon will put it up on Amazon just like all other books, and people can then buy it. So that technology has gotten a whole lot easier in about the last decade. And the one thing missing from that story is a mechanism for finding which books are worth reading. So that if a book has been commercially published, that doesn't prove that it's worth your reading, but it represents the top 2% of the flesh pile, so to speak, and that makes it much more likely. And so what I think is really needed in order for self-publishing, self-publishing is in fact quite lively, but in order for it to really take off to largely replace the current publishing model, you need some mechanism for filtering, some mechanism for identifying which ones are worth reading. And I've thought various things about that. But it occurred to me that fanfic might be worth looking at, because that's a community where you have had this problem for quite a while, and where I'm at least told by sort of casual conversation they do have online mechanisms for sort of trying to point out what's good or what's bad. So that struck me as an interesting, for somebody who is sort of ambitious, it could expand into the general issue of how you produce written works in a world without copyright. It could concentrate on what's the legal status of fanfic. There are lots of other things. Yeah?
Do you have to take sort of a hard stance as your thesis, or can it be an exploration of the legal?
That's really up to you. You know, if I'm the world's only neutral on IP. That is to say, everybody else in the world either thinks IP is clearly a good thing or thinks IP is clearly a bad thing. My view is there are good arguments on both sides. So that's certainly a possible position to take. I want to know more when I finish reading your story, your paper, than when I start. And I would like the paper to have a noticeable amount of your own thinking. I think a paper, I'm not sure that a paper that was only a summary of 15 published law review articles would be unacceptable, but it would be pretty boring for you as well as for me. So what I really like people to do is to look at some set of issues and say interesting and original and intelligent things about them. And the answer that might take the form of, we should absolutely abolish copyright law, or we should absolutely change copyright law to allow for fanfic in the following fashion. I'll tell you a real story about copyright law getting in the way of doing useful things. One of my hobbies is cooking from very early cookbooks. And a long time ago, I discovered that there was a Spanish translation of a 13th century Spanish Muslim cookbook. and I got various friends who shared my interests and who, unlike me, knew Spanish to translate the Spanish translation into English. And for a little while, I distributed that to people, and then I stopped doing so because I realized that it was covered in principle by the copyright of the person who had translated from Arabic into Spanish. And I was not able to get in touch with to locate that person. I don't even know if he was still alive or the relative heirs. This is in Spain. I don't speak Spanish. What I eventually did do was to find somebody who was interested in medieval Islamic cooking and who read medieval Arabic. And he went back to the original Arabic and, with some assistance from my retranslation, did the whole thing into English. So that's now been available on my webpage. It's a very interesting cookbook. Got a lot of neat stuff in it. But that was a case where, which sort of makes me more sympathetic to copywriters getting in the way, that the guy who did the original translation, if I had to guess, assuming he was still alive, he would have said, isn't it a wonderful thing that people want to translate my work into English so more people can read it? But in practice, it couldn't be done. And I should say there's another Spanish Muslim cookbook from about the same period where I've never solved that problem. That is to say, I have a English retranslation somebody did, and I can't distribute it because doing that would be violating copyright law, and I don't know of any way of getting permission. And I have not gotten the same person to translate that one. Maybe somebody else will eventually. It'd be nice. Anyway, but that's just an example of sort of the downside. So anyway, I was just sort of thinking about it as an interesting thing to think about. That I think one of the real issues, to me at least, a lot of the interesting, many of the issues in IP have been with us for 100 years. As the book makes clear, there's this 19th century argument of whether IP is a good thing or not. But there are certain ones which it seems to me are relatively new, are implied by current technological changes, and those are especially interesting because there's been less thinking about those. And one of them is what I like to refer to as the death of copyright. How do you achieve the objective of copyright if, for technological reasons, copyright becomes unenforceable, as I think has already happened in some areas in the process of happiness. All right, that's enough of all of that. So now let me go back to what we were talking about last time, which was Coase, and ask whether you have questions about the ideas discussed last time or about the ideas in the article of mine that you've all read or any of that. Anybody? All crystal clear? Yes. We will get to doing some of that. We've really sort of implicitly done that earlier. I've discussed the ways in which some of these issues are relevant. But I was planning to go to say a bit more about Coase, then say some stuff about the relevance to IP, and then if there's any time left to get into some economic ideas that are going to be showing up in your reading for next week that I thought were worth doing. But so far, people don't have questions about the ideas. All right. So what are the implications, before we get to IP, what are the implications of the Coasean approach to law in general? And one way of looking at it is what I refer to in my book Law's Order as a spaghetti diagram. That is, you imagine that you have, with regard to some issue, a number of possible starting points, each defined as a way in which legal rights could be defined. So the particular one I'm discussing there is Pigou's old example of railroads throwing sparks. And you could imagine a legal regime where railroads have no liability at all for starting fires with their sparks. You could imagine a legal regime where the railroads are liable in tort and have to pay damages. One could imagine a legal regime where the farmers have an absolute right to enjoin the throwing of sparks, to tell the railroad it can't operate unless it does something to prevent sparks. You can imagine a variety of different possible starting legal reasons. You can then imagine a set of possible endpoints. What might be the efficient thing people actually do? So one possible endpoint might be sparks and fires. It might be that the cost of preventing sparks is higher than the damage done by the fires. I should say in the hypothetical there, in order to make it a good Coasean case, not only can the railroad prevent the problem by putting spark arrestor on its chimneys, on its stacks, the farmers can prevent the problem by switching from wheat to clover, from a crop that burns to a crop that doesn't burn. So sparks, wheat, and fire is one possible outcome. Spark, Arrester, Wheat, No Fire. There's another possible outcome. You can run down the list of, you know, No Spark, Arrester, Clover, No Fire, Spark, Arrester, Clover, No Fire, which seems redundant because each of them is sufficient by itself. But those you can think of. And you can then say, starting at each of these points, how would you get to that outcome? So if you start out with a rule where the railroads have an absolute right to throw sparks, then getting to sparks, wheat flour is perfectly straightforward. The railroad throws sparks, and if the farmers find that the loss from the fire is less than the loss from switching to clover, they grow wheat. Similarly, getting to sparks, clover, no fires, is equally straightforward, because now the railroad throws sparks. This time the farmers observe that it's better, they're better off to move. So those ones are easy. But if you want to get to the, from here to the spark arrester, you need a negotiation in which the farmers somehow get together and pay the railroad to put a spark arrester on. That's how, if you started from the railroad has all the rights, how you would get to here. And that's blocked by the transaction called, by what we would describe as the public good problem, the fact that each farmer says that the others pay him to do it, I'm home free, and if the others don't, I'm not going to be able to do it myself. So therefore you have a route from here to here, but the route runs into a transaction cost problem. Alright, you can describe that problem. And you can similarly do, you can see, if you imagine, you can see why I'm calling the spaghetti diagram, because from each of these we've got an arrow to each of the possible outcomes. So it's sort of a tangle, and some of those arrows we say, well, if this is where we want to end up, starting here is easy. Others we say, well, if this is where we want to end up and we start here, we might do it, but there's a problem doing it. And then you could imagine, if you sort of imagine constructing a legal system with unlimited knowledge, as it were, you would say, all right, what is the chance that each of these is going to be the right outcome? What are the costs associated with getting to it, not getting to it in each case? Do a sort of probabilistic calculation and say which starting point on average minimizes costs, on average does the best job of getting us to the efficient outcome. So that's a way of thinking about constructing law, which I find sort of an intriguing way of looking at the problem. It's not like we really have the information to do it, but it's a way of thinking about why might one want to have this legal rule, that legal rule. If you're sufficiently interested, I think that's chapter 4 of my law's order, which is available on the web for you to read. But that sort of is just to sort of discuss one way in which the Coasean argument can go into thinking about law. A different way, but a related way, maybe a different version of the same thing, is in thinking about what's included in property rights. Does the ownership of the land include the right to enjoy overflights by airplanes, drilling that sucks oil from under your land, and so forth? And there, again, a way of thinking about it due to Coase, ultimately, is which rights belong to the other. Which are the ones, such as if I own this right, I'm probably the person who most values that right. So if they start together, we don't have to have the transaction costs of my buying one right. I think I may have mentioned to you the case of Pennsylvania, state made out of coal. Property right includes surface right, mineral right, and support right. And if we knew that it was almost always the case that the owner of the surface was the person who was most likely to value the support right, so that his house wouldn't fall into a coal mine, then it would make sense to have the legal rule be that the owner of the surface right starts out with the support right, and if the miner wants the support right, he's got to buy it from them. Whereas if you thought it was the other way around, you might want it the other way. So all of that is sort of interesting stuff that comes out of Coase, not directly IP related, but I think it may be clear why that's relevant. Let me go on with Coase, because Coase points out that one way of solving these problems, which is in a sense a transaction way, is if you have two activities which have this problem, two activities where what I do plus what you do causes a cost, to have them both belong to the same firm. So if we put the interacting activities under one roof, if we put the creator of the externality and the victim of the externality, if you want to think of it in those languages, although it's better to say that people taking the incompatible actions in one organization, now the problem disappears. And, you know, the very easiest case is if I both own the steel mill and am the only person living downwind from it, now I will fully take account of the pollution costs when I decide how to run the steel mill. And you could even push that further. Suppose the area downwind from the steel mill is where all my workers live, and the only convenient place for workers to live. In that case, the worse the air is, the harder it's going to be for me to get workers, the higher I'll get, the amount I have to pay them in order to get workers to compensate them for that. So that will, in effect, be transferred from them to me and become a cost of my operation, and it then pays me to do it right. And as I think I mentioned a week or so ago, an example of this solution we're all familiar with is the shopping mall. So you go into Valley Fair, and Valley Fair is a private, I assume a single firm, I don't know the details of it, which in effect is coordinating a bunch of interacting activities that whether you have a restaurant affects whether people come to the stores, whether you have stores people want to come to affects whether they come to the restaurant, whether you go to store A is affected by whether store B that you'd also like to visit is there, and so forth, and whether you go to any of them depends on whether there's a place to park. So the owners of Valley Fair have the option of what I presume they do in adjusting what tenants they rent to at what rents, of trying to include all of those effects in order to maximize their own profit, and it then pays them to provide free parking, as they in fact do provide free parking for people for doing that. So that's sort of an interesting example of just the point that he makes. So, is that the right answer? Coase basically says there isn't a right answer. There are answers that have different costs and benefits, and that in some cases, you might say, look, I want to be able to run my own store. This idiot mall says that I can't put the following display in my window because they think that I'm running what's the store that sells sexually suggestive women's clothing? What? Yeah, Victoria's Secret. I'm running Victoria's Secret. I'd like to have this really sexy display on. But the owners of the mall tell me, sorry, that'll keep people with small kids from coming to our mall. You can't do it. And you could certainly imagine transaction costs involving bargaining among the tenants and the mall that might more than outweigh the advantages of the coordination, which is presumably one of the reasons why not all stores are in malls. So Coase is not saying, in general, sort of one of the general points that Coase is really making in that article is that there isn't, in general, a perfect solution. That, in a sense, Pigou and a lot of other people say, well, look, there's something wrong if we are anywhere short of perfect efficiency. And I like to define perfect efficiency by imagining what I call a bureaucrat god. And a bureaucrat god is a cross between Joseph Stalin and Mother Teresa or something. The bureaucrat god knows everything anybody knows, has complete power to give orders that people obey, and is maximizing total welfare, maximizing economic efficiency. And then inefficient means short of what a bureaucrat god could do. And what's surprising is that in some simplified models of the economy, you actually get an efficient outcome. Perfect competition is a standard example, but it isn't what you ought to expect. And therefore, what Coase is saying, instead of merely saying this is inefficient, there's something wrong with it, say, what are the alternative ways of dealing with this problem? Which one is least bad, in effect? And, yeah.
So, thinking of one though, so I guess kind of like, I know for a while, a little longer, the Disney store was actually next to the Victoria's Secret.
Uh-huh.
And it's 5 minutes with it, I think.
Huh, that's interesting.
Down to like Robbie's store and like Willow Store.
That's interesting.
For a while, I was like,
but I don't know, but it might be a case where they in fact decided there was a problem. I don't know. Maybe they think that Victoria's Secret attracts people to the Disney store. But more likely not. But in fact, a long time ago when I was thinking about these issues and knew much less about it than I now do, it seems to me that the ideal economic arrangement was what has sometimes been described as an agoric economy, coming from the Greek agora for marketplace, in which everybody is an independent actor. So you could certainly imagine replacing a firm, replacing the university, let's say, with a network of contracts, so that I wouldn't be an employee on salary. I would be being paid, say, by you directly. Take the pure form would be one, which Adam Smith, by the way, lived in a large extent and describes. Smithy, the Scottish universities, when Smith was there, most of the professors did not have a salary. They were paid by the students. They charged the students to attend their classes. And Smith, in fact, Smith did, I think, have some salary. I think there were some endowed chairs, but not a lot. I think he had one. But Smith has this wonderful discussion of how terrible the way we run our universities is, written 200 years ago, where he's targeting Oxford, I think, and he has a comment that, you know, the professors at Oxford have long ago given up even the pretense of teaching, because they all had endowed chairs, in effect. And he describes all of the devices by which professors can pretend to teach without doing any real work. It's quite a fun passage, which most people haven't read in Smith. But in any case, you could certainly imagine a fully agoric university model in which each of you was paying for each of your classes. Some firm or individual was renting classroom space and dorm space and so forth, and instead of having one firm, it all went down to single rooms. And in some ways, it's very attractive that I know my daughter, having graduated from college, is planning to be a freelance online editor, and part of the reason is that she wants to work for herself. And I think a lot of people feel that way, and there are a lot of jobs people do work for themselves, a lot of lawyers are in individual solo practice, others are in big firms, and I think if you imagine both of those things, you can see attractions to both of them. That the big firm, you don't have to worry about hiring a secretary, you don't have to worry about renting the building. On the other hand, there are other people who, in a sense, have authority over you and who you've got to coordinate with, whereas the solo practice, you're running your own life. So in an emotional sense, I still find the agoric order very attractive, but then I read a very interesting book which discussed why that arrangement used in the 19th century largely disappeared. It was what we refer to as the inside contracting system. And the inside contracting system, you want to build rifles, let's say. So you have a building, and the building has got five different firms in it. And one of the firms makes stocks for rifles, and one of them makes the action for rifles, and one of them makes the barrel for rifles, and I don't know what the fourth one does, and the fifth one buys from the other four and assembles the rifles and sells them. And that was a functioning system. It existed. But the author argued, over time, it turned out that a firm doing all of the things, once people sort of worked out better ways of organizing firms, was actually superior, because with the inside contracting system, if something went wrong with the people who were making the stocks, if the guy running that firm died and his kids were arguing about who would take it over, suddenly everybody else shuts down because you can't make a rifle without a stock, and there's no point in making a barrel if nobody's going to buy the barrel to assemble into a rifle. So that there was a coordination problem in that system, which could be solved by hierarchical centralized organization within a single firm, and there were trade-offs, advantages and disadvantages both ways, but on the whole, over time, it tended to shift away from that sort of agoric order. So, yes. I hope people can see where this is leading in terms of IP. What author that we have been reading and have been talking about is arguing for the firm solution to the IP problem? Nobody? Isn't that Titch's solution to Titch's view of patents? Right? Titch is saying you've got a coordination problem for patents among the first innovators, the first, and so forth. What's the solution? Turn it into a property right, give it to one organization, that organization will coordinate everything. So we really are getting back to what we were talking about a week or two ago. It's just that we're seeing it as one example of a much broader set of issues, of the trade-offs. As I think the book actually I'm remembering, I think its title was Market and Hierarchy. And the point of the book was that there are advantages to both. There are advantages to coordinating things through the market, and there are advantages to coordinating things through hierarchy. And in a market society, in fact, as I think I put it a long time ago, it's sort of odd that the capitalist beach is made up of socialist grains of sand. That is to say, the individual firm is like a little tiny socialist state. It's a hierarchical structure with somebody giving orders, and yet those firms are existing within a market order where they've got to get voluntary customers and voluntary employees and so forth. And that's an sort of odd and intriguing feature of the world we live in. But I think the arguments both from Coase, whose theory of the firm, different article than this, was part of what started that set of ideas. He's actually been productive in several different parts of economics. And the guy I was reading, who was, I think, Oliver Williamson, if I remember correctly, Market and Hierarchy, interesting book. Unfortunately, he never uses two words where nine will do, but he still has good ideas, which is more important. So in any case, so that's sort of a general issue of those trade-offs. to keep going for a moment before we get back to IP, as Coase says, another solution to these problems is government regulation. That's sort of where we started. So another solution is the government tells the steel mill what it can do. That also has its problems for reasons that I think I went into a few days earlier, where the government may not have the information it needs, may not have the right incentives and so forth in order to do it. And a final solution to all of these externality problems is to do nothing at all. All right? If you think about it from the standpoint of each of us, the rest of these people in the room are a part of our environment. If somebody chooses to wear a combination of colors that clash in the aesthetic view of other people in the room, they are imposing a negative externality. If somebody chooses to look particularly delightful, they're providing a positive externality. You could imagine any of these solutions to that problem, and they exist. When I was an undergraduate at Harvard a very long time ago, I was required to wear a coat and tie in the dining hall. And there are private schools that have dress codes of one sort or another. So it's not absurd to imagine trying to incorporate that set of externalities into something like a firm or a regular structure. But in fact, most of the time, we don't. That I observe a considerable diversity of dress styles in this room or on this campus. And we, I think the view of most of us is that trying to optimize on that dimension would just be more of a pain than the benefits would be worth. So as I say, where a couple of other points Coase makes that I was going to mention very briefly, I think I've really said, well, one of them I've already said, which is that the existence of inefficiency doesn't tell you you have the wrong answer. It might be less inefficient than any of the other alternatives. And going back to Coase, that laissez-faire and government intervention are not really well-defined. That is, going back to Pigou, that Pigou is taking it for granted that the laissez-faire answer is the railroad can throw sparks and start fires with no liability. But that wasn't, in fact, the rule under English common law as it previously existed. There's nothing more natural about saying the railroad has the right to throw sparks than there is about saying, I've got the right to shoot you, or take your property. Those are sort of the real question was, what are your property rules in this particular legal system? You could imagine a variety of starting points, no one of which is obviously more natural than another, and in fact different societies have different legal rules, as my other seminar makes strikingly clear, my other course. So therefore, really, the right way to think about this set of issues is, what set of rules do we want? What property rights should people have if we want to maximize economic efficiency or achieve something else? But that's the one we usually talk about. All right, so let's now bring this back to IP. I think basically how all of this fits into IP should be reasonably obvious, I hope, that in the whole process that produces innovation, there are a whole bunch of my action plus your action has costs or has benefits together, where it's not immediately obvious that who has what right to do what. So that when somebody translated that Arabic cookbook into Spanish, he was providing a benefit for me. And in theory, the legal rules we have are ones designed to give him that benefit by letting him forbid me from publishing my English translation into Spanish translation without his permission. So that's, in theory, a way of letting him, in deciding whether to do the original Spanish translation, take into account the benefit that somebody else might retranslate it from Spanish, because it's a lot easier to find people who read Spanish than people who read Arabic, I can tell you, having tried both. So maybe not as much true now. There are more Arabic speakers in America than there were 40 years ago. But in any case, on the other hand, in that particular case, you can observe, I think, that it didn't work, that the transaction costs necessary for me to be able to use via copyright law to reimburse the original translator for his work were large enough so that I didn't do it, and instead I got someone else to translate from the original instead. Right? So that's a case where, but that's in the copyright context. You could describe that as innovator and improver. The original translation is the innovation. Having it also available in English is an improvement. Ditto if you go back to patent law, the stuff which we discussed in, was discussed in your reading sometime in the last couple of weeks, which is that one person invents somebody, someone else makes improvements. Well, in principle, you could say, let the first person have a strong property right, and then if the improvements are worth making, you'll bargain with the improver. And we discussed at some length the transaction problems that that runs into. And you can do it the other way around. You can say, let the property right of the first inventor be narrow, and we say, aha, that looks like it gives too low an incentive for the first inventor. Ah, but the improver-to-be, in principle, can go to the first inventor and say, Mr. Watt, I've got this great idea for improving steam engines, but I can't do it until there are steam engines to improve. Would you mind inventing a steam engine, and I'll pay you some money to do that, and then I will bring out my, and your patent won't cover my improvement, because this is, we've now shifted to a world of very narrow patents, so once you invent your steam engine, I will invent my great improvement, and I'll get rich, and I'll pay you some money for you to do it. That's a conceivably that's the way of doing it, but it's hard to believe that that would have worked in that historical context. So I think this way of thinking about it helps you see what the arguments are that we've been chewing over and how they are part of a much broader set of interesting questions about how to organize human affairs, so to speak. About, again, I think just the phrase markets and hierarchy doesn't get all of it, but it captures part of this tension in how we organize things. I should say, what I think is pretty clear, theoretically and empirically, is that markets scale better than hierarchy. That is to say that the problem of doing something on a market doesn't get harder when you have a million people instead of a thousand people. The problem of organizing a hierarchical organization does get harder when you have a million people instead of a thousand people. There are more layers of hierarchy. But there may be some problems which hierarchy is still a better solution. All right. Obviously, the people who supported the Soviet Union thought that up to the national scale it was a better solution. I think they were wrong on the evidence, but it wasn't an absurd belief, and lots of intelligent people held it. And I think it is quite clear on the evidence of societies like ours that market does not defeat hierarchy all the way down. That there are reasons why, although a noticeable number of people are self-employed, I'm self-employed as well as an employee of a university because I give talks and get paid for it, and I write books and such, but that a very large part of the population is employed within hierarchical firms, and the fact that that's sort of a stable situation suggests that for many activity sectors, that's a better solution. All right. So that's the generalization, and we're theoretically discussing it in the IP case, but I think it's only a small part of a more general issue. So, putting it differently, if you had zero transaction costs, then what I've just run through is why everything works. Right? A world with zero transaction costs, broad patents work because the first inventor coordinates the activity of all the improvers, narrow patents work because the improvers subsidize the first inventor. Zero patents work because the people are going to use the product. In a zero transaction world, the mine owners who want a steam engine to pump out water would subsidize Watt to make his invention. And so that's a much more zero transaction world than the other two I'm discussing, but it conceptually exists. But in the real world with real transaction costs, you then have to think more carefully about how you want to do it. Another way of looking at this, feeding into what we're doing, one which I'm going to come back to a little bit later when I start talking about the stuff in our next set of readings, is to think of a patent as a negative Pigouvian tax. That is, we usually think of a Pigouvian tax in the case of a negative externality, where we say you put out air pollution and we will charge you for it, but conceptually it would apply to the positive externality where I put out wonderful smells from my bakery and I ought to be subsidized for it. Well, when I invent a new invention, I'm putting out the equivalent of wonderful smells from my bakery. I'm benefiting the rest of the world. If there were no patent system, once I make the invention and other people learn about it, they can do it too. Everybody's better off. Big gain. I can't capture that, so I don't make enough inventions. So patent is one way in which you can give me do what Pigou says, namely, give me the benefit of what I'm producing. And thinking of it that way, the obvious question, which we've really been on before, is how do you measure the value? How do you decide how much the world is better off for watch dimension? And the patent solution is not an absurd solution. It's sort of an ingenious solution, though it's got all sorts of problems, and that is by what people are willing to pay to use the idea. I mean, that's the guts of what patent is doing. An alternative, but there are problems with that, which some of which we've discussed. Among other things, it means that the idea gets used less, because even though you're using the idea, it costs me nothing, I charge you for it, and therefore some people don't use the idea even though they should. Therefore, an alternative would be a prize, but the prize solution, you then have the question of how do you figure out the value of the invention, and as with lots of regulatory things, both how would a perfectly well-intentioned prize giver figure it out, but second, how would you have institutions where the people who set the prize are really trying to figure out social value, trying to, rather than saying, well, my friend is working on this project, he's almost got it, I'm going to announce a big prize for it. Right? So you've got to figure out how you would solve that set of problems. Other issues that come in all of this, if you think about the two chapters of mine that you read at the beginning of this course, where I'm discussing patent versus copyright. And part of my argument there is if you ask what's the proper reward for IP, it partly depends on whether when I get my patent or copyright, I'm depriving other people of something they already had. All right? So that in the case of patent, and this was an argument that was running through the 19th century, the defenders of patents say, look, you aren't really infringing on other people's rights because they couldn't have used your invention if you hadn't invented it, so all you're getting is what you created. And the other side said, wait a minute, I'm also keeping them from creating it. Right? So that's what I think of as depleting the commons. If you go back to Locke's old arguments about turning the commonly owned wilderness into private property, as long as there's enough and as much and as good available for other people. In the case of patents, there may not be as much and as good available for other people because you are taking something of value, namely the opportunity to make this invention and use it, and taking it away from other people. Consequently, if you could really get the full value of the idea, you'd be overpaid. Right, that would be more than the value you're producing. And one way in which, that's the two ways in which patent law tries to deal with that, really. One of them is by the term of protection. So that if you say, look, in 14 years, just about 14 years, someone else will come up with the same idea. Great, you only have your patent for 14 years. And the other is by having various restrictions on granting patents, which at least are designed to make sure that the sort of thing that would have been reinvented in 6 months doesn't get patented. That's what this non-obviousness and stuff like that is supposed to be about, I think. I guess that's where all of this sort of feeds together. I don't know if it's clear or not, but if it's not, you'll have to ask me questions because I think as clear as I can make it at this point. So before I go on, the next thing I want to talk about, because it's what's going to be coming up in your next reading, is price discrimination, which is of interest. The general issue is the collision between antitrust law and patent law. That's historically gone back and forth, basically. I think when patents originally came in, people didn't really think of that as much of a problem because there wasn't any antitrust law to some extent in common law, but that was pretty limited. Then at some point when people were very enthusiastic about antitrust, you end up with a situation where practically all patents, if they ever really make it to the top levels of the court, are found invalid for one reason or another, and short of that, where lots of things that a patent holder might do are found to be an abuse of their patent. And you then have a development partly coming out of economic analysis of law. I mentioned Coase's dinner at Aaron Director's house, and Aaron was probably responsible for an idea that someone else then published as an article in the journal that he wrote, analyzing the real facts of the Standard Oil antitrust case and demonstrating that the supposed facts were largely mythical. That in fact Rockefeller did not engage in predatory pricing. He did not drive people out by selling below cost. he, on one occasion, one of his people threatened to do so, and the targeted firm, which was a much smaller firm, basically said, feel free, we will export our oil for 50 miles around, you have to get your price there too, you're going to lose an awful lot more money than we are, because you're selling a lot more oil than we are below cost. And he, as the guy in this anecdote, which is out of the Standard Oil hearings, reported, and he went away, and I never saw the man again. He basically betrayed back then. But anyway, but so there was a bunch of work associated largely with Journal of Law and Econ in the early period, which questioned the economics and the history underlying the view of antitrust, which among other things had justified restrictions on what patent holders could do with their patents. And so that's changed. Notice, I'm not really up on the latest last 10 years of that literature, so maybe there have been changes in the other direction, but basically, if a bunch of issues which have to do with the intersection really legally between antitrust law and patent law, and economically with the attempt to make economic sense of things monopolies do. So if you say, all right, we observe that a monopoly, whether due to a patent or something else, engages in activity X, one question is it a good or bad thing? Should we try to stop it? A different question is, why are they doing it? And those are obviously linked, because if you don't know why they're doing it, you may not know what its effects are going to be. So a lot of that involves price discrimination, which is what I thought I would probably be spending the rest of this talking about. And the... Let me start with the sort of simple story, which some of you have probably... Some of you, I'm sure, have taken econ classes, and some of you haven't. This is a demand curve. The demand curve shows how much people will buy as a function of price. So we imagine that this is the market for cookies, and if imagine that for some reason I've got a monopoly on selling cookies, I've got the only good recipe, I invented the chocolate chip cookie and patented it, and so if I charge a very high price, I'll make lots of money, but I won't really make very much money because nobody will buy my cookies. Down here somewhere we could imagine is my actual cost of producing cookies. That's what we call a marginal cost curve, and what that shows me is that it actually costs me 10 cents per cookie to bake cookies, and to make life simple, I can produce as many cookies as I like at 10 cents each. In the real world, marginal cost might go up, it might go down, it might be that there were economies of scale, so the price gets lower if I bake a lot, or diseconomies, or whatever. Take a simple... Similarly, my demand curve I'm drawing is a straight line because it's easier to draw demand curves as a straight line. There's nothing in the world that makes demand curves straight lines. Okay? So I'm the cookie monopolist, and I say, what price should I charge? And I say, well, if I charge that price, this would be my profit per cookie. Here's your price and cost. This would be the number of cookies, so this area would show how much profit I was making. I can imagine different prices, and eventually I work out that there's some price at which this area is maximized. Suppose it's there. And if there's an econ course, I'd talk about marginal revenue and marginal costs and how you find the maximum. That doesn't really matter for our purposes. What matters is only that there's going to be a price. I'm certainly not going to charge someone at marginal cost, because at marginal cost I make no money at all. Some price up here is what I do. And the economist looking at this may say, well, this is a very inefficient arrangement. Because, look, there are all these people here who value cookies at more than 10 cents and aren't getting them. Notice, by the way, a point that's going to become important in a little bit, the demand curve might be different people or it might be different quantities for individual people. So you can imagine that what's going on is that nobody wants more than one cookie. These are really big chocolate chip cookies. So no one wants more than one cookie. And there are some people who really like cookies and are willing to buy a cookie at a high price, and down here is somebody who will buy one cookie only if it's 10 cents. Alternatively, it could be there are a whole bunch of identical people. These are not such big cookies now. And what's going on is that each person will buy one cookie a week if they're expensive, two if they're a little less, three if they're a little less, and so forth. It's going to matter which of those two stories is going on, but those both are going to show the same way in the demand curve, because it's just summing everybody's demand for cookies. All right? Fair enough. So I say, I'm going to charge this price, maximizes my profit, and the economist says, you evil person, you, look at all that dead weight loss. And all those people who would enjoy your yummy cookies, they would be willing to pay you a price which would cover your costs. All right, most of them are willing to pay you more than your costs because their value is higher than your 10 cents, and you're depriving them of cookies. And I, in the monopoly, say, you know, you're right. You're right. I mean, I'm not sure I put it exactly your language, but it does occur to me that there are all these people here who I ought to be making money out of, and I'm not. And that's really not a very satisfactory situation. Somehow, so you know what I'm going to do? And now we're going to assume for a moment that everybody's identical, and that this is just the multiple of the individual manager. But I say, what I'm going to do, I'm now going to switch imagining this diagram to be a single customer, just that I know there are 10,000 identical customers out there. And I say, all right, this is 3 cookies a week. And this, which is 25 cents, is the price I've been selling cookies for. But I'm a generous person, and I believe that people enjoy cookies and ought to have cookies. So I'll tell you what. After you buy 3 cookies a week, I'll sell you additional cookies at a price of only 15 cents each. All right? So now I get this area from these cookies, and I get that area from those cookies, and I say to the economist, yes, it's true, I'm still losing. There's still a little bit of dead weight loss there, but not very much. And by the way, I'm making more money than before. Isn't that a nice arrangement? But you know, it seems to me really, I should say I don't have to do it in the continuous form. I can do it in the form of saying, I'll only sell you cookies once a week. These cookies keep pretty well, fortunately. And if you want 3 cookies at 75 cents, and if you want 6 cookies, it's 75 cents plus 45 cents is $1.20. All right, so I could do it as both. But you know, I say, I've been looking at this diagram that this economist was so careful as to show me. And it occurs to me that it's really unfair that when I do all the work in inventing the chocolate chip cookie and making them, that these people up here are getting their first cookie for a price way below what they pay for it. They're getting that first cookie for 25 cents when it's worth 45 cents for them. But, you know, I think I'm going to take this a little bit further. I think that I'm going to have a system where if you want one cookie, it costs 45 cents. If you want 3 cookies, it's 45 plus 50. It's 95 cents. And if you want 6 cookies, it's whatever this figure turns out to be. Now I'm making even more money. I'm happy. Right. Well, it just so happens that the newest member of my firm is my daughter, who just graduated from university with a degree in economics. And you know, Dad, this is a pretty clumsy way of doing all this. And besides, look at all that stuff you're still missing. All right, there's that benefit people are getting that you're not putting into your pocket. That's not really fair. We ought to do better than that. How about we replace this whole system by a slightly different, by a slightly different pricing scheme? Our new pricing scheme is that in order to buy cookies, you have to join the cookie club. And if you join the cookies club, you can buy all the cookies you like at 10 cents. And guess what the admission price to the cookie club is? The full value to you as a consumer of being able to buy all the cookies you want at 10 cents a piece. This is what the economists call perfect price discrimination, alias two-part pricing. All right, because what am I doing? Notice, I didn't mention, because this is an econ class, but I should have, this area, if this is a single person, really represents the benefit to him of being able to buy all the cookies he wants at 10 cents. Because after all, this was the value of the first cookie, this minus that is the benefit he gets from buying that first cookie, and similarly as you go along the curve. All right, for anybody who's comfortable with calculus, is the integral of marginal value is total value. If you're not comfortable with calculus, forget about that. But conceptually, that's how much better off you are from the opportunity to buy cookies at 10 cents. So now all of the benefit is transferred to me. What a wonderful arrangement. I can, in fact, I'm going to turn over the firm to my offspring who came up with this clever idea and is now going to run it, and I'll go off and play golf in Florida. All right? So that's perfect price discrimination. And it has a number of interesting features. The first is that on the face of it, it solves the economist's objection. because we now have an efficient arrangement in which everybody who values a cookie at least 10 cents gets it. Now, it's true the benefit all goes to me instead of the consumers, but that doesn't strike me as a serious problem. And total benefit, economists only care about the total benefit, I'm getting it. However, it does depend on my customers all being identical. Because once the customers are not identical, this scheme breaks down. Because now what happens is that there's a customer here whose demand curve is only down there, and he looks at my offer and says, sorry, I'm not joining your Greek club. The benefit to me of cookies at 10 cents is only this triangle, and that's not enough to pay for your admission. And by the way, there's somebody who really loves cookies out here, and I'm not getting all of his benefit because I'm only charging like that. So perfect price discrimination, one problem with perfect price discrimination is going to be differing customers, at least with this scheme for it. Can you see a different problem? What am I going to have to worry about? Let's go back to all the customers who are identical. Cookie club entry fee, 10 cents a cookie for all the cookies you want. Now, what am I going to have to be concerned about? What do you think some clever customer is going to do? Yeah? Order what? Well, I'll be costing him 10 cents. I don't mind if he takes all the cookies. What am I afraid he's going to do with all those cookies? What? Resell. Resell, of course, because some clever person is going to pay me for the cookie club. He's then going to buy three times as many cookies. He wants to go to his friends and say, look, 15 cents a piece for these yummy cookies. You don't have to pay for the cookie club. All right? So one of the problems with maintaining price discrimination in most mechanisms for doing it is how do you control resale? All right? Can you think about what kinds of activities make controlling resale easy versus hard? That is, one way is to have something where it's not practical to resell. Another way is to have something where somehow the costs of getting it from one person to another are high. But let me start with the first. What is the category of things of value that you can't resell? Yes? I want to ask for a category of things of value where resale is not an option. A very large category representing a sizable chunk of all the economic activity. Yeah? Licensing. I'm not sure I understand licensing for what. If I license you to buy cookies, you can still buy cookies and sell them to him. Yeah?
Like perishable goods?
Perishable goods are in the right direction, but there's something very big that's instantly perishable. I can't resell transportation if suppose the airline says, as it once said, that people under 21 can have standby tickets at a low price. I can't buy two of them and have my father use one of them because my going twice doesn't make up for his not going at all. All right? Medical care. All right? If the doctor charges rich people a high price and poor people a low price, the rich person doesn't get his butler to get the operation for him. All right? So any service, basically, is in practice, most services, I'm exaggerating a little because you could imagine that my son gets the discount ticket and then I borrow his ID, and if the people aren't paying enough attention, I might be able to cheat on it. But as a practical matter, services are generally things which you can't resell and therefore provide a lot of opportunities for price discrimination. All right? Now, but there are other categories as people are mentioning. Yeah. What are other ways? Let me scratch this case because I want to go away from identical people. Now let's imagine that I'm selling a product to very diverse people, and it occurs to me that there are some people who are willing to pay a higher price for it than other people. And the question is, how do I, as a clever seller, manage to get a high price from the high-priced people without losing the low-priced people? And what are some of the ways you could imagine by doing that? Yeah?
I think with technical offers, you could sell
yes. Bain Books, which published my first novel, so I like them. But they're also interesting because Jim Bain was one of the few people in the publishing industry who saw the Internet as an opportunity rather than a threat. And one of the things he did was to sell e-books pretty early on. But he had a special twist on selling e-books. And that was that there is a what's referred to as an advanced review copy, ARC, of a book, which is a copy of the book before the last stage of proofing and editing, which is usually on not very good paper. It's sort of a low-quality one, and it exists to be sent out to potential reviewers because you want the reviews to come out when the book comes out, and therefore you want them to get it in advance. So what Jim did was to have an EARC, an electronic advance review copy, but it wasn't going to reviewers. It was going to the enthusiasts for a series who wanted to have read the next book in the series before their friends had it. So the way he priced it was he has a book which is coming out in January. He's got the EARC ready to go in September. You want it in September? $15. You want it in October? $13. You want it in November? I'm making up the numbers. But that was the basic scheme. It was really a very clever idea. He's unfortunately no longer alive, and we'll see whether Bain Publishing ultimately survives the loss of its founder and moving spirit. He also accepted my novel, which shows he was a good guy. But in any case, but that's an example of exactly what you're describing. It's not exactly fashionable, but it's the enthusiasts who want it early. There's another version of that which is very common. It is not uncommon, though it doesn't always happen, for a book to come out first in hardcover and then in paperback. All right, well, what's going on? There's a double dimension of discrimination there going on, I think. One of them is the people who really like the book, the real fans, want a copy they're going to read multiple times, lend to friends, so they'd rather have the high quality rather than the low quality copy. But the other is that if the hardcover comes first, the enthusiasts don't want to wait. Now, it's a little tricky because, of course, it also costs more to produce the hard copy. But my impression is that usually the price difference is quite a lot more than the cost difference, and that, therefore, part of what's going on really is a version of price discrimination. All right. Can people see other ways in which you do it? Let us suppose that I am publishing a book in the English language, and it occurs to me that not all English speakers live in America. And it also occurs to me that average incomes are different in different countries. So I have a British edition of the book and an American edition of the book. And the British edition is sold at a lower price than the American edition because I will suppose that seems plausible. I don't know if it's true, but on average incomes are lower in Britain. So I'm guessing that the demand curve is lower and the profit maximizing price in Britain is different than in the U.S. So if I had to combine the two markets, I'd have to add the two demand curves and figure out what price does best there. But if I separate the two demand curves, I can, in fact, shift some sales and make some low-price sales in England without undercutting my American market too much.
This might be somewhat of a tangent, but is this, what we're talking about, somehow related to, it seems to me that movie companies could put out movies in the theaters and distributed through DVD and streaming services concurrently, but usually there's a how many months away. Is that just to drive up demand? Or?
That I presume is because they are getting less money per showing from the DVD. Therefore, they would rather have you watch it in the theater than watch it via DVD, is my guess of what's happening. And the eager people will see, will be willing to pay the price of going in the theater. That's what I presume. I don't know anything in detail about that market, but that seems like a plausible story. Let me take a different version, because we're talking about movies, because that's an interesting one in several ways. One thing I might do is to say, look, some customers put aside how much they like the movie. Some customers are rich and some customers are poor. And some customers are young men showing off to their date how generous they are. And they would be willing, when the new movie comes out, to pay a higher price than the mother with five kids who's taking them to the movie. How can I get them to do it? How can I get the people who are relatively willing to spend money to spend more money for my movie than other people? Yeah?
Can you charge more on Friday and Saturday night?
That would be one way. How about charging, yeah?
Marketing,
But there's a price, so I've got now one thing I can do, of course, is have a lower ticket price for kids, which is a little puzzling because kids use up the same number of receipts and there may be more of a nuisance than adults, but kids are poorer and parents with kids, because they're buying several tickets, may be more price sensitive than singles. But the other thing I can do is to charge a high price for popcorn and soda. Because after all, the person who is rich or the person who's showing off will still buy it at a high price. And the person who's poor will smuggle in their own. All right? So this is an old puzzle in economics, which is why popcorn is expensive in movie theaters. I discussed it in my price theory textbook a long time ago. And the non-economists will tell you popcorn is expensive in movie theaters because the movie theater has a monopoly on popcorn. And you say, that's wrong. Because after all, the knowledge that popcorn is expensive makes you willing to spend less on the ticket. All right? If somebody advertised, we've got cheap popcorn and cheap soda, yes, our ticket price is a dollar more, but you're going to save more than a dollar on those things. You'd be happy to go. So the economist's explanation is that the expense of popcorn is price discrimination. The expense of popcorn is a way in which you can get those customers who are relatively willing to spend money to pay a higher amount for your movie than those who aren't. Yes?
As evidence for that, I know there's theater that involves popcorn and soda, but the atmosphere is kind of like a classroom chairs, and so it's not really, it doesn't really look all that nice.
Huh?
So it's kind of like, you know, and the streets are relatively small, so it's kind of 30 times the price.
So all of these are examples of ways in which you can engage in price. And there's another way, which is, I suppose, in some sense, the way I use. The classic story is the optometrist. When the customer is looking for a new pair of glasses, he asks, what's the price? And he says, $40. And if the customer doesn't wince, he says, that's for the frames. The lenses are $30. And if the customer still doesn't win, he says, each. All right. And my version of that is that I do a certain amount of public speaking. And if I'm being invited by a group that I think is willing to spend money, I have one price. And if I'm being invited by a group that I'm pretty sure isn't willing to spend money or who I'd like to give a talk to, I give the talk for free or for a lower price. And similarly in lots of other contexts. I do some teaching for free, for example, but it's done in contexts where I don't think I'm going to get paid for it, and the teaching I feel like doing, and lots of other stuff. I do lots of teaching for free because I argue with people online all the time, and nobody pays me for doing it. But I'd be happy to be paid if they wanted to. And actually, that's not fair. Very occasionally, they do get paid. I think on at least two occasions in the last couple of years, somebody said, we want to have sort of a formal exchange on the following subjects on our website, and we are willing to pay money to the people who will do the main articles, and the people will comment on them. So I have gotten paid for arguing online. It's not nearly often enough. I got paid for all the arguing online. I would be a very rich person. The basic argument is that there are a whole lot of ways in which a seller can deal with the fact that different customers have different values for his product and at least attempt to do what my cookie monopolist is doing, come as close as he can to getting each person to pay the highest price he's willing to pay. And then one point that's worth noting is that all of these require some amount of monopoly power. That is, if you imagine the economist's perfectly competitive world, the wheat market is a standard example, where you've got 10,000 producers producing identical goods. Well, if the cookie company says you've got to pay this sum for a cookie club, and they are making out like bandits, because notice that they're covering all their costs with the 10 cents, all the rest is gravy, another cookie manufacturer will say, we've got a somewhat less expensive cookie club. And if you run it through, as long as the cost of getting cookies is more than 10 cents a cookie, whether in price or in Cookie Club membership, it will always pay some other company to undercut it, and you then end up with 10 cents a cookie being the price for chocolate chip cookies. All right? So you need some degree of market power. But market power can come in lots of different ways. The one we're obviously most interested in is intellectual property. But if you think about the movie theater, there are multiple producers of movies, but movies aren't perfect substitutes for each other. So when a new movie comes in, it's not like you can, if they raise the price of Harry Potter by 3 cents, everybody will go see John Carter of Mars instead. They aren't very close substitutes to each other. Does John Carter Mars actually show anywhere around here? I want to see it because I read those books when I was young, and I thought that the Burroughs books, although they have certain bizarre characteristics which require what we refer to as a willing suspension of disbelief in the reader, but they're also a lot of fun. I mean, Burroughs is really a very good storyteller with a beautifully imaginative sort of lush imagination. And so I want to see how this turned out on the film. But it's probably available right now online somewhere so I can see it that way. But in any case, movies aren't close substitutes for each other. And therefore, when a new movie comes out, it really has some degree of monopoly position, of monopoly power. Similarly, there's nobody who's a perfect substitute for me as a public speaker. I give different talks than other people. So I have some degree of market power. And similarly for lots and lots of other things. Going back to, for a moment, to the question which we discussed a bit and then passed on, of where it's possible to price discriminate to prevent resale, and as I think somebody was suggesting, perishable objects resale becomes harder, that when I buy 100,000 cookies intending to take over the market, by the time I've sold them their pile of crumbs that nobody's willing to pay for, but also transportation costs, so that if you imagine that there are 10 different coal companies or 20 different coal companies, the coal heavy stuff. So with regard to the customers close to my mine, I have real market powers. There's a range of prices over which they will still buy. The higher the price, the less they'll buy. So those suggest lots of different reasons why you get this pattern. And then how is it relevant to IP issues? And the basic question is, when should terms of selling your patented or copyrighted product be held in violation of antitrust? Or when is it held that you're abusing the monopoly that you have been given? And let me run through a bunch of examples of things which it can be argued or it has been argued are, and it can be argued are not. And I'll start with the one which I think I mentioned before, which is a tie-in sale. That's the case where IBM says, if you want our card sorter, you've got to agree to use the punch cards that we will sell you at our price. Where A.B. Dick says, if you want to use our printer, you've got to buy our paper. Where I think the example, which is in what you haven't read yet, was somebody, I think it was in the shoe manufacturing, where you were stapling on buttons or something instead of hand sewing them. And if you want our stapling machine, which is a new and presumably patented machine, you've got to buy our staples. Those are tie-in sales. And as I discussed before, one way of making sense of tie-in sales is their price discrimination, because the use of the tied product is a measure of the intensity of the use of the monopoly product, and therefore, since the people who print 10,000 pages a week probably value the printer more than people who print 1,000 pages a week, by charging them more than market price for the paper and less than you would otherwise charge for the printer, you can in effect charge a high price to the heavy users and a low price to the low users. You never want to charge the low users a price below your cost, of course, but that marginal cost, that distinction I should probably make, so I drew this graph, you aren't all econ students, and that is the marginal cost is the cost of making one more or something. So if you imagine that in order to make printers, I've got to spend $10 million building a factory to make printers, and then each printer costs me $1,000 to make, my marginal cost is $1,000. I'd rather sell one more printer at any price above $1,000 than not sell that printer. But if I sell all the printers at $1,000, I'm going to go bankrupt because I'm never going to pay for the cost of building my factory. So therefore, there is a reason in that context. And that's connected not with IP, but with natural monopoly, because one thing that gives you a natural monopoly is a situation where there's a large fixed cost and then a low marginal cost, and therefore the more you sell, the lower your average cost is. So that's a reason why a big firm has an advantage over a small firm, which is what natural monopoly normally is. So tie-in sale is one. Another one that was, and I think still is, legally debatable is resale price maintenance. So resale price maintenance is that Apple sells to the companies that sell Apple computers. We are the wholesalers, we're the producers, but we'll only sell you computers if you agree not to sell a MacBook Air for less than $900, whatever the control price is. And I suspect that, in fact, Apple does have resale price maintenance, because I see a good deal less price variation than I would have expected to see in that market. And my understanding, and I'm not an expert at all on the law, is that in principle, resale price maintenance is not supposed to be permitted, but there are various effective ways around that restriction. Some people may know more about it than I do. But in any case, the basic form of resale price maintenance is that the wholesaler or the producer sets limits on the prices the retailers can sell. And that's activity which exists, and again, it raises the double question, why would they do it, and does it have good or bad effects? Another way of doing it is geographical market division. That's like my English American, but it may be that I've got a patent on something, and I will license you to produce and sell it on the West Coast, and him to produce and sell it on the East Coast. If the thing is sufficiently hard to transport so that people are unlikely to buy it for the West Coast from the East Coast or vice versa, each of them I'm giving a local monopoly on sales. Again, why would I choose to do that? Another possibility is a division by function, so that I could say, I'm producing steel, and I will sell steel to companies that make girders for buildings at this price, and I'll sell identical steel to companies that make cars at that price. And you can see, if you think about it, why that might make great sense as a form of price discrimination. Another form in which you get somewhat odd behavior is insistence on only selling package deals. And the famous case, to economists at least, which was in fact a legal controversy, was block booking by movie theaters. So a movie producer would say to the theaters, we've got 5 movies, we won't sell you one of them, the right to show one of them. We will only sell you the right to show any of the 5 in any order you like. And then the puzzle was, why would they choose to sell it in that form? So if you want our really popular Western, you're going to have to also take our less popular mystery. And single price for the bunch, so you can't really jam what you're paying for each one. So that was block booking, was another such pattern of behavior. And final one is vertical integration. When I say I have a monopoly on producing steel somehow, and I've decided that instead of selling the steel to the auto companies, I'm going to be the auto companies. After all, they can't build cars without steel, so I have a monopoly of auto companies now, and I'll make cars. So this is what's called vertical integration, because I'm integrating producing the input and producing the final product. Yes?
What's the difference between vertical integration and contract?
The only difference is that, you don't mean the inside contracting system, you mean what replaced the inside contracting system. The inside contracting system was not vertically integrated, but the ordinary integrated firm is vertically integrated. And then the question is whether if the way your vertical integration comes about is because you have a monopoly, is that objectionable? That is, I think it's clear that if there are good reasons, if Ford decides to make its own tires instead of buying them from Goodyear, that's vertical integration. But that might well occur for reasons that have nothing to do with monopoly. All right? Because Ford, that's not having the inside contracting system, that Ford does some things itself and some things outside. And then the argument that was made is that I'm using my monopoly position, for example, from a patented product, in order to get a monopoly of the industry that uses that patented product, then I'm abusing my monopoly. Right, that was the claim that was being made. And the economist's counter argument is to say, well, if that's all that was going on, it wouldn't pay you to do it. Because after all, you can push up the price of automobiles without owning an automobile company, just by pushing up the price of steel. Why do you get any additional advantage? Putting it differently, the sort of the counter argument against a number of these things is to say, look, Let me go back to resale price maintenance. The claim is you're getting more money because you're giving these companies a monopoly. But if you're giving them a monopoly, that means you're increasing their profit. The wedge between retail and wholesale is the cost plus the profit of the retailers. Why do you want to give them money? Why didn't you just drive up the price of the final goods by raising the wholesale price? All right, so that's the puzzle for many of these things. The initial puzzle is that the argument was that the monopolist can make money by doing X, Y, or Z because he gets an additional monopoly. And the economist responds, no, he really can't, but then the obvious counter reply is, then why are they doing it? And that's where it gets interesting. But I think we're out of time for the moment. So anyway, I'll be taking up more of this stuff next time, and you'll be reading, your reading for next week will cover stuff that's relevant to this.